This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. This week I was across in Glencoe, which is a fantastic location in Scotland. I mean, really, really dramatic. And they're trying to redevelop the visitor centre there just to explain it to people, because tens of thousands of people come here every single year just to see Glencoe.
Yeah, it was quite controversial at the time because there used to be a visitor centre right in the heart of the Glen, and then somebody said, this is a real eyesore and one of Scotland's beauty spots, so let's get rid of it. And you've been at the new one.
Well, what the new one is now 15 years old, but they're revamping it, but it's quite clever. It's quite clever what they've actually done with it, you know, and you'll hear it later in this podcast.
Yeah. And I've been out, somebody got in touch the other week saying, can you identify with this? Noises during the night. We had a good go at it, but it made me think, you know, there's a lot of strange noises out there. So I've been digging into that.
And you've been guilty of most of them in your time.
Well, pretty much.
Invasive non-native species of plants and animals that have been introduced either deliberately or accidentally by us to somewhere they don't naturally belong.
Yeah, in the past we've talked about things like Japanese knotweed and the North American signal crayfish. But another one is mink. I met up with Callum Sinclair, he's the project manager with the Scottish Invasive Species Initiative, who told me all about them.
Well, mink were brought to Britain as a part of the first farming trade in the 30s, and there have been a sequence of escapes and releases, deliberate releases, and they became really established in Scotland in the sort of 50s and 60s and spread across the north of Scotland.
Because it must have surprised people how successful a foreign beastie like the mink might be.
Well, they're just very, very good inhabitors and invaders. You know, they're predators, they're a flexible animal, they can move, they can take up different habitats, and they're just very good at colonising new areas and taking advantage of the opportunities we gave them as we released them.
Because people have been trying to shoot, kill and trap them for decades now, and they still thrived.
Well, they're still there. And I think what happened before with all those efforts to remove them, it was very often very localised, individual estates, individual landowners, individual efforts. And what we needed was something that was a bit bigger and a bit more coordinated to really take them from a wide area, because they can move large distances. So if you take a mink from one location, you may find one from 80 kilometres away has re-inhabited that patch. So you needed to work on a big scale.
And incredibly fertile.
Aye. They're just good at what they do.
It's kind of sorcerer's apprentice type thing, isn't it?
Yeah, they don't live for too long in the wild. You know, a 2 or 3 years old would be an old animal in the wild. But, you know, they can live up to 8 years in their natural places. So.
And what is the problem? I mean, otters, the decline in the otter was suggested on the interaction with the mink. Do they fight? Do they just compete? How does it work?
Actually, where we've got strong otter populations, they tend to depress the number of mink. But what mink are very, very good at is being very effective predators. So they can take other mammals, particularly water voles of high conservation interest, ground nesting birds and their eggs, amphibians, crustaceans. All those things are open field for the mink, and they are quite happy to take advantage of whatever they can find.
Now, some time ago, a decision was made to actually do something about it and get rid of the mink properly. Highly publicised project in the Western Isles. How did that go?
On an island situation, you're working on a sort of confined population, and there was a lot of effort put on to trapping and removing, and they made a significant dent, and I think they were content that they had removed the large majority, if not all, the population from that island situation. And in parallel to that, there were previous projects to this one, Scottish Mink Initiative, which grew from a North East Water Vole project, which were also targeting mink on a different scale and on the mainland.
But you had the advantage in the northeast that you had water on two sides. You were still forcing them into a corner.
Yeah. And with it, a lot of them were, that we were picking up tended to come inland from the coastal areas and coastal patches where they were able to find good places to breed and thrive. So, yeah, we were on a sort of mainland island almost on two sides, so that helped certainly.
OK, so you've got a successful project in the northeast, successful in the Hebrides. Where are you at now with it? What's the new project?
Yeah, well, the Scottish Invasive Species Initiative now covers 29,500 kilometres squared of Scotland, which
that's
is
huge.
It's a third of Scotland, and it's 1.5 times the size of Wales, if that gives us some sort of context. So it's a big patch we're trying to deal with, and we're starting from Perth, and we move north through Tayside, Angus, Moray, Deeside, Speyside, across to Inverness, over to west of Ross, and across to West Sutherland. So a big patch we're trying to cover here.
So is this getting serious? Not that it wasn't serious before, but is this kind of a country-wide approach now?
It's getting to that point. We're certainly receiving interest from people who would like us to expand the area further than that still. But based on what we have available to us now in terms of funding and resources, that's a big enough patch to be getting on with. But clearly, I think you've got to have some level of ambition, and CC's the level of ambition is to deal with a third of Scotland for starters.
But you are getting pretty substantial funding.
We are, we are. Scottish Natural Heritage is putting in 500,000. National Heritage Fund, and they're putting in £1.59 million, and we have value from the partners on top of that. So we have a total project value of in excess of £3.2 million.
This kind of changes the direction for heritage, because you always think of restoring churches or building football pitches. To get involved in wildlife management is quite a big step.
I think they're interested because of the environmental value that we're providing and by practical management, and I think also because of our engagement with people in the project. It's not just a natural heritage project, it's a people project. So we're really working very closely with communities and volunteers and supporting them, providing training, providing equipment. I've had to order 100 sets of wellies to support our volunteer network so that they can be equipped and come out and help us, not just on the mink control project, but on our work on invasive plant species.
Well, tell me what they'd be doing, because you've got this, it doesn't look terribly high tech, but it is a clever thing.
It's not very high tech. It's essentially a couple of planks of plywood with some polystyrene in the middle and a hole cut into the middle of it. And within that hole, we have a little plastic basket with a florist's oasis foam within it. What we then do is put some clay on top of that oasis foam and provide a tunnel for the mink. And they are inquisitive enough that they want to go inside the tunnel.
They want to have a look at stuff.
They want to have a wee nosy around in there. So when they're in, they can have a nosy around, but they also leave their footprints on the clay. And it's at that point we detect their presence in the area and can switch from the monitoring of the raft with the clay to setting a trap.
So this is to reduce the amount of resources, the amount of time you have to develop and getting traps out there and monitoring the traps.
That's right. And we have at the minute over 200 volunteers running over 400 rafts and traps for us. But the monitoring of the raft can be done just in a 5-minute nosy in as you walk your dog past. But it becomes much more serious when you set the trap, because that has got to be checked minimum every 24 hours to be operated legally, and then obviously we need to know about it very promptly when and if an animal's captured, so that we can come in, either release it if it's not a mink, or humanely dispatch it if it is.
You'll find them quite close to humans. You know, we've got folk walking past with dogs just now. Isn't it not just the remote highlands?
It's not just the remote highlands, but we've got to be very sensitive as to where we set these, because when and if a mink's captured, it is dispatched. And that's not particularly something that we want to be on huge public display. But I think also we've got to balance that against the need to be very upfront. This is an invasive species that causes significant damage, and we're seeking to remove them. And
yeah, the attitudes are changing, though, now. People are, you know, accepting that grey squirrels have to die to save the red. The mink's got to go to save the water vole. People need to be a bit more grown up about it, or am I just getting old and cynical?
I don't think you're getting old and cynical. I think you're getting where we are. I think we want to be upfront about this. We've got schools that have adopted mink rafts. We've got parents taking their young children to be involved in this as part of their contribution to being busy and being active in the outdoors and with the environment. So, you know, we've got a range of people that are helping this project, not just gnarly old gamekeepers and estate workers. We've actually got people who have a much wider interest in the environment than that.
Have you got room? Have you got the budget to buy more wellies? Do you want more volunteers?
We want as many volunteers as we can buy wellies for. So at the minute, we're working a big area from Perth North. And if anyone would like to get involved in adopting a mink raft, we would love to hear from them.
How many have you caught so far?
Till the end of the calendar year, we're at 71, and we've had a little bit of flurry in this season when they're out and about and active, so we're up over 80 at the moment.
Because you should be doing it now, aren't they? They'd be thinking about breeding. And if you don't catch them now,
That's right. They're out getting excited and bombing around the rivers and streams. So this is a key time for us to get volunteers and to get rafts and traps out. We had one trap last week was operating. It had 6 mink in 10 days on a single trap. So when you know the hot spots, we know where we can get the mink and get, have them removed.
Callum Sinclair from the Scottish Invasive Species Initiative. And I know they're a pest and I know they're extremely destructive, but they're beautiful wee animals.
They are beautiful and it's quite hard. It's a similar analogy to grey squirrels. Grey squirrels are lovely, but they shouldn't be here and they're destroying it for everybody else. And the mink take all the eggs of the ground nesting birds, take a lot of the fish, interact with the otters for territory, so they don't belong here, they've got to go.
They belong to the weasel family, Mustelidae, as do badgers. And I was talking to my neighbour the other day and I said, how's your hens doing? She has 2 hens left. Well, it's now 1 hen.
Really?
She heard a bit of a commotion going on in the hen house. She went out with a torch, shone the torch in, and there's a young badger just kind of standing there with this mouthful of black feathers going, what? What? This is what badgers do.
Yeah. I solved that after many decades of losing hens by shutting the whole thing up and making it proper badger-proof and putting the entrance for the hens at about 4 or 5 feet up, and the hens fly up. And you,
sadly, that meant you couldn't reach the eggs anymore either.
No, but what you do is, I can't remember where I saw it, you put a wee sugarly bridge up to it. So, you know, it's really precarious. The hens can walk up it, no bother. But the minute someone heavier gets on, the whole lot crumbles down.
You've been up and down the Caledonian Canal with your boat umpteen times.
Yeah, it's one of the great highlights. I mean, it's a long, I must admit, it's an expensive process. But there's something just delightful about going through these wonderful locks. The size of the stonework they use, just the simple elegance of the thing.
The canal itself is almost 200 years old, so understandably it's in need of a wee bit of maintenance at the moment. That has meant that a stretch at Fort Augustus has been emptied, completely drained, revealing the really quite incredible feat of engineering that lies below in a way that you just can't normally see. George McBurney is the project manager with Scottish Canals.
Up you go. So if you look to your left, to your left down the way.
My other left.
That's left. That's the chamber.
That is beautiful. That really astonishes me. Essentially, it's all stone lined. And I thought the bottom would be clay or something.
No. And all the chambers are the same. There are 5 chambers, 6 sets of gates at Fort Augustus. When you look at the chamber, masonry lined, masonry inverted arch. So we call them Telford's cathedrals.
It's a bit like a railway tunnel that's upside down.
It does, that's right. Yeah. And that's where it gets its strength. That's where the lock gets its strength from that inverted arch.
The quality of work here staggers me because Telford changed the face of Scotland in all sorts of ways. He built harbours, he built roads, he built bridges, he built canals. The Caledonian Canal was the thing that gave him the most headaches. He couldn't get the quality of workmanship, and this belies that.
Well, exactly. And we know that Thomas Telford, when he was here at Fort Augustus, had issues with water. And here we are 200 years on from that, carrying out a major works project, and we've got a little bit of a headache controlling water. And we've got modern equipment here to help, which is doing, it's certainly doing the job. But we know that Thomas Telford, and he did record, he had issues at Fort Augustus when he was here building the canal originally.
100, 150 metres further down from us, however many lock gates away, you can see the water being held back and pumped out, etc. It's actually quite a scary idea being down there with that weight of water the other side of the gates.
We have. We've got a temporary dam, which is a stop plank system. And that stop plank system was designed during the very early phases of the Caledonian lock refurbishment programme. And what you were actually doing is holding back Loch Ness. So we're holding back a lot of water. We don't want Loch Ness coming in to the lock chamber.
We completely ruin your day.
Exactly. On the other side of that temporary dam, we know that the water depth's about 5.5 metres. So we're holding back a lot of water. We need to make sure it's done safely. That is absolutely prime and first in all that we're doing here. We are extremely grateful to Scottish Government. There is £5.35 million of Scottish Government money invested in this programme over 2 phases, 2 years. What we're doing now is we're replacing Fort Augustus Gates 2 and we're strengthening Gates 3 and Gates 4. That will get us through the sailing season to the back end of this year. We've already placed an order for new gates for here at Fort Augustus. So we're going through a big learning curve this year, and that will inform us coming back next year. We'll be more ready, more prepared to to get on and get the project done. And that will secure the middle district of the Caledonian Canal at Port Augustus.
The lock gates that I'm seeing at the moment are basically like big steel walls. But at the bottom they are, for the lack of a different expression, cat flaps. What's the point of the cat flaps?
Those are the sluices. So that's how you pass water from the top to the bottom. There's a difference in level between Loch Ness and the top of Fort Augustus of about 12 metres. Mm-hmm. So to get that change in level, we need to pass water from the high end down to the bottom end. And it's the sluices that do that by filling and lowering the lock chamber. Every time we open the sluices and do a one-chamber locking, we pass 1,631 cubic metres of water. A chamber itself holds 5,160 cubic metres of water. Now, that's more than two Olympic-sized swimming pools in each lock chamber. So it's huge volumes of water that we're moving. The canal has been here for 200 years. The Caledonian Canal brings circa £7 million to the Highland economy. And that's in terms of boats, bike and boot. People come, they sail, they cycle and they walk. And that's fantastic. And that's why the canal's here. And that's why it's important in terms of this project, getting the navigation and getting the navigation back open. Fort Augustus is an absolute honeypot for tourists to stop and watch. And watch locks in operation, watch boats moving up, watch boats moving down. So it's really important that we get on with the project and get the canal back open.
Right now it looks as clean as a whistle, astonishingly clean. It looks like red sandstone that it's actually lined with that. Did you find anything when you actually drained this out?
We did. The chamber as you see it now, which is clean with not any silt or debris, that's the way we found it. And that's a consequence of the volume of water that comes through the sluices. So it's almost self-cleaning. While we were down there, we found the original mason's marks. So these were the timesheets of the day, 200 years old, and a mason was paid by his mark. And we've got various different mason's marks down there, which is an absolute fantastic find. They would be set a task to manufacture a set amount of stone blocks on a pallet. Those blocks on that pallet, they would put a mason's mark on a block of stone. When the clerk of works of the day came along, he would identify which mason did which pallet and they would be paid appropriately.
It's just absolutely extraordinary. You know, seeing this with that, I mean, it's impressive when you actually see boats in this. It's even more impressive when there's no water and no boats in it. It's just extraordinary. It's like a man-made canyon.
It is, and the reaction from the public, not only the people who live locally, but from the tourists. For example, we had an open day here on the 8th of March where we actually invited members of the public to access the chamber, safe access by a stair scaffold. And the response to that was overwhelming because this is quite unique. To see these structures dewatered and the scale of the structures, the quality and the workmanship is absolutely fantastic. And for us, as asset owners and as engineers, it's actually quite a privilege and quite overwhelming when you actually go inside the chamber and look and just think this is what our forefathers did 200 years ago, because that is a fantastic piece of engineering and that is a testament to the people who hand dug it, who laid the stone and just made sure that the locks at Fort Augustus would be there for 200 years. We're now looking to secure that for the next 200 years.
George McBurney, project manager at the Caledonian Canal, and I am frankly heartbroken that I wasn't there when they actually had that scaffolding stairs going down into it. I would have loved to have gone out the bottom of that.
That's scary, though, all that water above you.
Yeah, I'm trying to think where else I was. Kishon. Kishon, where they actually built the concrete oil platform. And again, it's a huge dry basin, and it's the sea is being held out by these massive concrete walls. You know, and you can see little trickles of water coming through, and you think, yeah, just because it stayed like that for 25 years doesn't mean it's going to stay like that for another 25 seconds.
Of course it does. A couple of the locks at Fort Augustus, as you're going up them, it is such a tourist magnet.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to get it wrong. When they open up the water, there's a wall of water coming in. Mm-hmm. There's boats going always. And quite often, you'll have people on higher charter boats who've never been in a boat in their life. One of them lets go of the rope. It is like being in a washing machine. It is utter chaos. And you've got all the tourists there, just there to see the chaos unfold in front of you.
Yeah, well, I've sat and watched it. Where were we? It was at the end of the Crinan Canal.
Aye.
Watching that one. Now, that was pandemonium. It was great fun.
Yeah, I remember my father-in-law coming in this decades ago, in the days when his engine was temperamental, to say the least. And he didn't have reverse. Ah. So he would time it and then chuck a bucket over the back and try and stop himself.
Oh, well.
Tales from the canal.
Aye.
I remember one that was a very, very expensive yacht came in. A pompous, take my line, my man! And threw the line up, but had forgotten to tie the other end on. Thousands of pounds of yacht smacked. And the keeper goes,
fair enough.
Sorry, we digress.
As we normally do. It's been a while since we had a soundscape on the podcast. We have actually been sent a couple of great ones recently that people have recorded on their phones, and we will play those out in future weeks.
If you've got one, wherever you are in the world, something dramatic, just record it on your phone, email it in. But I thought I would get out at night and just, we'll find out a bit more about what makes these strange noises. Nighttime in the woods can be a scary affair. There's the crackle of the twigs as you walk, there's the settling of the birds, and then, what the heck is that? Well, there's two great sources of scary stuff in the forest. The owls and the deer. What you're hearing is a fallow deer getting ready for the spring. Which is fine when you know what it is, but it's dark and it's a threatening sound. Something that deer specialise in. Like the mount jack, it sounds like Jabba the Hutt let loose in the forest, a giant toad coming after you. Now, I defy anyone to be just a little worried at hearing that somewhere in the thicket. Then, of course, there's the owls. This is the easy stuff first. The tawny owl, the classic twit of one, followed by the too-woo of the other. But even the tawny owl has a sinister side. Then there's the barn owl that wants to get in on the act. And then back to deer. And the roar of the red deer stag in full rutting mode. The little owl is perhaps a little less threatening, but it's still enough to stop you in your tracks. Of course, not all that scares the wit out of the nocturnal walker is a deer or an owl. A fox, in fact. A male and a female. In this case, locked in what appears to be a rather painful act of mating. But not to be outdone, the short-eared owl has to get in on the act. But perhaps the strangest, spine-tingling sound is that of a beast sniffing, possibly for you. Well, it's not sniffing you out. It is, in fact, a hedgehog on the hunt for some worms after the long winter's hibernation. So if you're out in the woods tonight, enjoy.
I've always admired the moderation with which you edit things together and mix it.
The Phil Spector wall of sound, it's not work well unless you overcook it.
It's not exactly a light touch, is it? Just whack everything in there.
This isn't...
I'm sure there was howler monkeys in the middle of that.
This isn't Radio 3. You get a bucket of sounds and you chuck it in a big cement mixer.
And see what happens.
Yeah.
Glencoe is famous all around the world. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people come to Glencoe every year for a whole variety of reasons. Sometimes it's just the scenery, sometimes it's the history. Sometimes it's that feeling of being in somewhere that's quintessentially Scottish. Now, the National Trust for Scotland actually own a big chunk of it, and they are revamping the visitor centre. But before I got to the visitor centre, I went to look at the Glen itself with Emily Bryce, who's their operations manager locally.
We're currently standing on a rather windy bank of the river, beside the River Coe, looking up Glencoe with the Onachigach, which is enshrouded in mist on our left, and the buttresses of the Three Sisters looming up above us on the right.
This is one of the most iconic landscapes in Scotland, and we were seeing it in absolutely perfect conditions because the clouds down to about 2,500 feet, so the whole thing's lowering. There's a sort of slight menace to it. There's just patches of snow on the summit. You're getting these rivulets of white water coming down these dark cliffs. Everything's in autumnal colours, so it's all sort of buffs and greens and the copper colour of bracken and things. But thousands upon thousands of people from all over the world come here every year because this is Glencoe. How did the National Trust for Scotland actually manage to acquire this? When?
Glencoe was acquired by the National Trust in the 1930s. It was in several packages, but it was one of the early landscape purchases that the National Trust for Scotland had. And it was made possible, really, by the generosity and the strength of will of Scotland's mountaineering community at the time. Particularly an individual, Sir Percy Una, who was the chair of the Scottish Mountaineering Club. When the estate came up on the market in the 1930s, when Lord Strathcona was selling it, Sir Percy Una and the Scottish Mountaineering Club and many other mountaineering clubs around Scotland really spearheaded the fundraising to be able to acquire this and give it to the National Trust.
What was their argument at the time? Why did they think this was important enough to save for the nation?
I think it was a place where there was a foresight, really, that it had the potential for being developed, and its wildness was something that mountaineers back then and hillwalkers and mountaineers today really valued. It was right at the heart of the development of mountaineering in Scotland back at the turn of the century. They were concerned that if not donated to the National Trust, for whom many of them at the time were closely involved, then it could have a lot more development, a lot more paths, a lot more buildings, and they wanted to avoid that. They appreciated the what they call the primitive nature of the estate back then.
It is extraordinary. I mean, you mentioned the Onachigach Ridge, which is probably the finest ridge walk in the UK. It's terrifying. It's been years and years and years since I've done it. You've got the Hanging Valley on the other side. This is climbing areas all throughout here. It is rare, even in the worst of weather, not to see the car parks half full and people wandering all over this, and yet it still maintains this kind of primitive, wild, scary feel.
Yes, you do get that atmosphere in Glencoe, which I think, as I say, considering just how many people travel through it, you can very easily and quickly get away from the populace and just find your own quiet spot with the looming mountains around. And it's an atmosphere that you don't get in many places within Scotland in this extent.
Remind me, how many Munros have you got on your patch? But I'm asking this the day after the 100th anniversary of the death of Sir Hugh Munro.
So we have 8 Munros within our Glencoe estate, and that's an estate of 14,000 acres. And within those 8 Munros and the surrounding landscape, there's about 60 kilometres of footpaths that we maintain as well. So it's a sizeable chunk and there's a lot of people who walk here. Probably about 150,000 hill walkers and climbers come to the mountains here every year. What we have is footpath counters at various points around the estate, and that gives us quite a good steer. But something that's quite interesting has just come on really that we're starting to look at is using apps like Strava, where people record their walks and their runs and their climbs, and you can have a heat map which shows you where people are walking most commonly within the landscape. And so that's a really good tool for our rangers to see the most popular routes, areas where there are maybe not a footpath but there's a kind of a shortcut, and we can see that everyone's using it. So that's a new form of technology that's proving really useful to the ranger team here.
It's heat map just a turn of phrase, or are you actually measuring body heat in certain areas? No? A heat map is just an indication of footfall, really.
Yes. I don't think it's... Yes, it's not about the actual heat that these people are kind of creating. It's...
Because you've been hiding to nothing on a day like today.
No, I don't think it's an infrared-based thing. It is purely just the number of people who are recording that route with GPS within their phones and their watches.
That's how it works. Okay. They say that the camera doesn't lie normally, nor does the microphone, but you can hear we're standing beside the river. Beautifully clear, lots of different coloured pebbles underneath the water. There's a slight greenish, almost a glacial tinge to this water. The gorse is in bloom, but literally 40 metres away that way is the A82. There's folk whizzing up and down it doing 70 miles an hour, and you would be unaware of it.
Yeah, you do, as I say. You get away from the road very quickly at Glencoe, and that's why people enjoy exploring here every year from all over the place, all over the world, whether it's coaches or people on their own individual journeys. And so that's why the visitor centre is so important, because it acts as people's gateway to Glencoe and gives them the ideas for where they can then travel on from there.
I know you've had the visitor centre shut for winter as per, but you've been tearing it to pieces and trying to rejig it. So let's go and have a look at that and see what you've been up to.
Emily Bryce there from the National Trust for Scotland at Glencoe, and we will explore the visitor centre proper later in the podcast.
It's one of those places you think, you know, what a cliche Glencoe is, and then you stand at the head of the glen. It's a cliche for a reason.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really fantastic.
You're listening to the Scotland Outdoors Podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElroy.
You can catch up whenever you want by getting your podcast from where you get it delivered. And not only that, share it with people. We're proud of what we do. We're proud of our country, you know. Get out there and share it with us, because it's just a great way to get a wee flavour of Scotland.
We can't pretend to be social media gurus, because we're not, but apparently if you like us, and it's got nothing to do with stoking our egos, it helps other people find us. So if you could take a couple of seconds, something like that, that would be quite useful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you can get the weather podcast, as you know, from the BBC Radio Scotland website, and we do like hearing your stories. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. That's what Andy Sutherland did.
He said, "I thoroughly enjoy listening to Out of Doors." Now, that's the live programme we do. He says, "It's entertaining, it's informative, and I get to vicariously be out of doors in Scotland. Quite different from the place where I typically listen to the show. Normally, I'm sitting on the second floor of a bank in the state of Delaware dealing with fraud on bank accounts. Thank you for the diversion." It's a great pleasure, Andy.
What a great service to the world of banking.
Yeah. Anyway, this week saw the 100th anniversary of the death of a man called Sir Hugh Munro. His name is now synonymous with mountains in Scotland over 3,000 feet.
Yeah, he was tasked by the Scottish Mountaineering Club to list all the mountains of 3,000 feet, as you said. But perhaps he was helped by a man you probably haven't heard of, Professor Matthew Forster Heddle. I met his great-great-grandson, Hamish Johnson, who told me all about him.
He was born in Orkney in 1828. He went to school in Edinburgh, and then he studied medicine at the university, after which he practiced in the Grassmarket area. But he wasn't really suited to patients and medicine. His real interest was mineralogy. He had a precocious talent for it, so much so that at the age of 23, he was elected president of the Edinburgh Geological Society.
And he travelled all over Scotland.
He did indeed. He spent the 6 summer months when the university was in recess. I should say that he went on to become Professor of Chemistry at St Andrews. Every summer, the 6 months, he spent exploring Scotland to try and achieve his ambition of writing the authoritative encyclopedic book on Scottish minerals.
And on the way, He climbed a lot of mountains.
He did indeed. In fact, he created his own list of 3,000-foot mountains before Sir Hugh Munro, or Hugh Munro as he was then, before he had published his tables. Heddle had 409 as against Munro's 523.
So was he trying to climb the 409, or was he on the hunt for minerals?
Well, it was both. I mean, there's no doubt that his priority was his mineralogical science, but there's also no doubt that if he had put climbing the 3,000 as first, he would easily have done it many years before the Reverend A.E. Robertson.
But he must have been incredibly fit.
He was indeed. He had a reputation for long-distance walking. His books and papers include just casual references to things like, I walked all the way round Rum, or I walked from Stornoway in Lewis to Tarbert in Harris, and such things as that.
Carrying hammers and a bag of minerals.
Indeed, in one of his papers, he describes in Southwest Ross how he had a 4-pound hammer at his side and a 14-pound hammer over his shoulder.
And climbing mountains.
And climbing mountains and collecting specimens and all the rest of it. A very, very strong and hardy man.
Did Heddle and Hugh Munro meet?
They did indeed. They met by chance in 1883 on a mail coach travelling from Kinyusi to Fort William. Heddle was on it because he'd been invited to participate in the opening ceremony of the Ben Nevis Observatory. They talked on the coach for something like 2 hours, and thereafter, Munro, who was only 27 at the time, Heddle was 55, immediately acquired a huge admiration for Heddle and had a huge regard for him.
Did he nick his idea?
It's difficult to say.
Or was it there for the having? Yeah,
I think it was the Scottish Mountaineering Club was established in 1889, and it had already asked Munro to do the research and create the list. But with him knowing Heddle, there's no doubt at all that he knew of Heddle's considerable achievements. For example, by the time he stopped climbing in 1892, he had done 357 of the 3,000ers, whereas the Reverend Robertson at the same time had done barely 10.
So did Munro have access to Heddle's work?
Well, he did, because Heddle provided Munro with about 15 aneroid measurements of mountains that he had climbed that the Ordnance Survey hadn't climbed, and he used these, and indeed measurements by other climbers, in the tables. But I think it's very likely that Heddle would have given Munro his own list of 409 to help him on his way.
Very generous of him.
Heddle was above all a scientist who believed in truth and information. He was a teacher and he shared information very freely.
So should we be climbing Heddle's rather than Munro's?
That's a good question. The answer to that is no, but I think it's really important that people know what Heddle did and what he achieved and his position and role in Scottish mountaineering. And I think it would be great if his name was much better known than it is today.
Sadly, it's a name that not many people will have known about.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, if you look at the mountaineering literature, there's a book by Ian Mitchell called Scotland's Mountains Before the Mountaineers, and he doesn't mention Heddle at all. Ken Crockett wrote Mountaineering in Scotland, the Early Years. He has a passing reference, but not very much. It's not because people think that Heddle doesn't deserve to be recognised. I think it's simply that people didn't know about him. He wasn't a self-publicist, he wasn't a clubbable man, and all his writings, bar two, were all about science.
How can we put him on the map?
People like yourself finding out about Heddle and asking questions. At the moment, he's featured in an exhibition in Perth, organised by the Munro Society, and I do quite a lot of lectures and publish articles all about Heddle. The reaction is usually one of great enthusiasm and great interest and indeed surprise that he should have achieved so much and be so little known.
That was Hamish Johnson there talking about his great-great-grandfather, Professor Matthew Forster Heddle, the mineralogist.
Getting out into the hills, go and climb a Heddle today. And we'll be coming back with that. It's going to feature in our television programme, Landward. We're looking at the work and his climbing. And we'll also, on Out of Doors, I've actually been looking at his collection in the Royal Museum of Scotland.
I was very envious of that.
Because, well, I actually felt guilty because I'm a bit of a geosceptic, as you know.
Yeah, you don't believe it.
And you love rocks. You've got your own personal collection.
Sad but true.
Many of Scotland's mountains are slightly smaller than they used to be
Used to be 3 feet taller until I got there. Anyway, you know the importance of naming things, you know, of actually putting a title on something, you think, right, fair enough, now I know what you're on about. Ghost signs.
Signs that aren't there anymore?
Signs that are nearly not there anymore. Once this phrase was actually introduced to me, I thought, that's a really clever idea, because you see it in towns and cities all over Scotland. You know, old advertising things, old pieces of information that have just about been worn away,
gone, but, still
but
there.
Not quite there. There's a new project being run by Glasgow City Heritage Trust, concentrating on what they're referring to as ghost signs. I went to look for some with Niall Murphy and Daisy Jones from the Trust.
I'm looking down an alleyway at a very faded painted sign. It's hard to make out what the words on it actually say. It's 32 Bell, I'm assuming, Street, because that's the street that we're just off. And it's actually quite hard to make out the top line, which looks like it says Harters?
Napier?
Napier? Oh.
Could be Napier's.
Is this a characteristic of ghost signs? You can barely make them out.
Absolutely. At times they are incredibly faded. It's a bit of archaeology in the city and trying to figure out who was here beforehand as well.
When I heard about this idea, I thought, why hasn't this been done before? Because Glasgow particularly is littered with these things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it has been done before and is being done in other cities. There's a big one in Dublin. London was one of the original ones. There's a Facebook group for Edinburgh as well. And then there's one for New York. So it's an international thing too. And there are people in Glasgow, photographers, who have been interested in ghost signs, but there's never been a sort of coordinated project around it. So we wanted to really sort of create an archive of these signs and to really document them all and find out more as well about the histories.
I was about to ask you, is it just a case of plotting their location, or do you want to find out, you know, if that does say Napier, who Napier was?
Absolutely. For instance, we know that this lane used to have a lot more activity down it, and Tontine Lane is an incredibly important lane in the history of Glasgow. This was where Watts' laboratory was, where he kind of discovered the condensing vessel for the steam engine. So it was here, a world-class event was on this lane, but there's no record of it, except for there's a wee plaque on the other side of that building that tells you it, but, you know, blink and you'd miss it.
Just something about the architecture of this place too, because it's everything about it, it's like a palimpsest to a certain extent. You know, there's lots of, I mean, here we've got glazed brick actually coming through the tunnelway. You've got iron gates which can be locked off at night. This is Harold. This is old red brick here, which is painted over with this ghost sign on it.
Yes.
You've got buddleia growing out the railings. I mean, it's just classic Glasgow.
Absolutely. This is all City Improvement Trust territory around here. So the City Improvement Trust, they were working from about 1866 onwards, and that was where Glasgow was incredibly innovative. It was surfing the zeitgeist at that point, and it was the city architect at that point, John Carrick, took a delegation to Paris to see what Haussmann was doing in Paris for Napoleon III, and he brought those ideas back to Glasgow, and they basically rebuilt the whole of this part of the city in this much grander style. So this would all have been little warrens down here, full of tiny sort of early Georgian buildings, all completely swept away. And he documented the whole thing in a series of photographs. So he got Thomas Annan to do this fantastic series of photographs all around here, which show what these kind of little closes and vannels were all like.
The examples of the ghost signs you've come across so far, I mean, this is one, and it just happens to be next to your office, so that's really quite handy. Where else?
There's a really good one up by Queen Street Station, the former North British Hotel, which has actually been uncovered by the current renovation works at the station. So it's still just about visible, but it's clear that once the station's been fully renovated, it will disappear again.
That's infuriating. You know, it comes, it goes.
I think that's part of the charm of it and part of why we want to document them, because I think the thing about ghost signs is they're something that you walk past every day and they sort of get a bit lost in the urban fabric. You don't necessarily notice them. So part of the project is to draw your attention to them, to document them, to get photographic evidence, because they're not something that lasts forever. They're something that by their very nature are fading, and one day they will no longer be visible. I mean, it's clear even with this one, it's no longer quite obvious.
Yeah. Well, we're struggling.
So it's about sort of recording that.
And who's actually doing the recording?
We've got a project coordinator, Sylvia Scoper, and she'll be leading on the project. And part of her job will be to recruit volunteers. So if anyone was interested in getting involved, it's very much a kind of idea of a sort of people's army all together.
It's not so much citizen science as citizen archaeology, really, isn't it?
Absolutely, like crowdsourcing the information, because it's impossible for any one person to know where all of these things are. We've got now social media feeds at Ghost Signs GLA. So, yeah, if you follow us on that, you can submit things to us, and we hope to sort of be the receptacle of all this information about ghost signs and to do some more research and find out about it.
It's like turning over a rock, you know, but underneath is the second city of empire.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the North British Hotel, that is actually so important to the history of Glasgow. There are a whole load of kind of key events that happen in and around that building. So you've got the Battle of George Square on the back of that, 31st of January, 1919.
Is that when Churchill sent in the tanks?
Essentially, yeah. So the tanks never actually get sent in. They're based in the...
Don't spoil the story for the facts.
I know it's never been. But anyway, there was a machine gun nest put on the North British Hotel. There were machine gun nests on the City Chambers, the GPO, and the North British Hotel in order to kind of suppress the activities in the square. So you've got that, and then in the Second World War, there's a cabinet meeting, a key cabinet meeting that happens within that building, where you get Harry Hopkins, who is Roosevelt's envoy to the UK, who's assessing the morale and the will of the British people to fight the Nazis. And he gives this great speech to the cabinet in that meeting. And that's one of the key things that brings the US into the Second World War. You know, he's going to go back and tell Roosevelt that he absolutely supports the British people. And apparently, Churchill's left in tears at the end of that meeting. And yet there's nothing that really records that this fantastic event happened in the North British Hotel.
Niall Murphy, Deputy Director of Glasgow City Heritage Trust, and Daisy Jones, who's Heritage Outreach Manager.
I live in the northeast of Scotland, near a place called Turriff, and the local newsagent had one of these horrible garish plastic chain signs on it, which seemed to pollute many of our towns and cities. But they sold up, moved out, took the sign off, and it was a delightfully hand-painted dispensing physician sign underneath, and the list of all these qualifications and things like that. It's great. And we have the sad legacies of the banks.
Aye, quite.
As they close, they take the sign off, there's a kind of square hole where the cash machine used to be, and yeah, it's a bit sad, but it's a modern day ghost sign. Mm-hmm. You see the faded images of the Bank of Scotland, or the Royal Bank of Scotland. Or,
yeah, all of the above. I just thought it was a clever idea as an arts project. Last year, I visited Community Woods in Maricuta, just west of Aberdeen. It was a former forestry commission plantation which had really undergone a major transformation into a native woodland. They've been adding artworks to it slowly but surely. The latest addition is a new sculpture built and designed by Stan Brooks, who's a mature student at Grace School of Art in Aberdeen. It's called The Nest, and Helen Needham learnt more about it from Stan.
It's a free-form sculpture, okay, which is made out of 408 pieces of wood that have been screwed together in a particular fashion. It is 7'6" high, 4.5 metres wide, and weighs almost 11 tonnes. This wood is actually called Greenheart wood. It's one of the densest, hardest woods in the world. It's come from Ghana. It was going to be buried as waste where I've been given it. This is a bounty of nature, this wood. I have got one of the pieces etched, and I reckon it's about 300 years old. Why waste this?
So what was it being used for?
It was actually used, because of the density of the wood, to hold up a tank that was at minus 44 degrees C. It did its job very, very well, but it's now got too old to be used, and that's where the wood came available to me.
And where was that?
This was at Sullivan Terminal up in the Shetlands.
Right.
And I was lucky enough to convince the managers there that this is what we should be doing with the wood. Let's not bury it, let's make it to something useful. So this sculpture is actually going to be here for about 100 years. As it stands now, at that point it will start deteriorating. So in 200 to 300 years, archaeologists will be going, oh, what's this mound? What's this circular
mound? Where did
mound?
This come from?
Where did it come from?
Yeah.
But there is a time capsule. One of the schools wants to put a time capsule in. So they've gracefully allowed me to put a little letter in it about where the wood came from.
Ed, if you maybe like to take some of the children to the other side and find somewhere to put this one in.
My name is Ed Thorogood. I am one of the directors of a charity which owns the community wood in Merikuta. It's a circular structure and it's made out of separate blocks, and there are gaps between each block. And in those gaps, we've been placing insect hotels, which are really just bundles of sticks. And the first ones that have gone in have been made by pupils at the Lehillock School. And every pupil at Lehillock has had a chance to make a bundle of sticks. And today and next week, they're coming in to insert their bundles into these holes.
Okay, so we've got one there, so maybe go over this side and we'll put it in.
It's just really simple structures that they've put together. You've got bits of moss and bits of paper and bits of cane.
The feedback I'm getting from the children is that they loved it.
Yeah.
And you can see that with the love and the care and the tension when they came out to the woods to put their nests in. They made all the logs that are cut through with holes. The school children sat for ages helping, and the ones that were strong enough to hold the drill, drill the holes themselves. These are been put in here deliberately as a request from Merikuta Woodland Trust, and this is for us to attract solo bees.
Who knows why we just put lumps of wood in that's got holes in it?
For bugs.
And I think one of these two gentlemen here might give us a bit more enlightenment. Enlightenment.
Nigel Astell. I've been working in the wood with Ed and a number of other members of the community for a number of years now. When it was just a commercial spruce wood, there was very, very limited biodiversity. And that means a very, very limited number of species. Few birds, except on the outskirts. So if we can get the number of insects in the wood up, we increase the birds, but we also increase the bats.
You're hoping to attract bees as well?
Yes, there are a certain type of bee, a solitary bee. These aren't the honeybees that, you know, live in huge communities. They're called solitary bees because obviously they live alone. And they're just another type of insect that we'd like to encourage. Many, many insects are having problems due to lack of habitat, due to some of the insecticides that are used in this day and age. So if we can have an area where more and more of them can live without being subject to these pressures, then we'll be happy.
We keep quiet. What do we hear? It's coming in down from behind us.
Birds!
Birds!
Yes.
Birds!
Things!
Now, I started building this a year ago. It's taken me about a year to build.
They're singing.
And from a year ago until now, the amount of birds singing in the woods has increased.
When we bought the wood, there hadn't been an awful lot of thinning done by the Forestry Commission, so that was one of our first jobs, is to come in and thin, and that allows light in, and that it's amazing how much the birds appreciate space to fly around.
Have you noticed the difference?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's why people get so enthused. It's so rewarding, and you get it's instant improvement.
Yeah.
And you see the impact of your activity. If you thin out a stand of spruce, the birds are there the next day.
Really? And what kind of birds?
Well, it's all sorts, ranging from various types of finches and tits. There'll also be lots of things like blackbirds. And then we have some of the bigger birds. So there are lots of buzzards in the area. There's a heron that comes fishing down the Crynock Burn. So all sorts of things.
And you look so happy when you talk about that.
Well, yes, the wood for me is like a safe haven. It's, you know, whatever else happens in the world, I just know one bit of the planet gets better. It's restored, and I can cope then a bit more with loss of habitat elsewhere.
I've had a few people now tell me that they think the piece is dramatic, but at the same time, it can nestle and live within our natural world. Be beautiful, but be practical at the same time. There's not many art pieces you can actually say will increase not just human footfall looking at it, but the actual presence of insects, birds, mammals.
So it's actually a living sculpture?
It's a living sculpture. I actually designed it from day one. From the first time I saw the wood, I knew I wanted this to be some kind of living sculpture. I wanted this wood, this beautiful nature that took 300 years to grow, to end up back in a natural environment, having a use And eventually what will happen is that it's got so many nutrients in this wood, in 200 to 300 years' time, it'll actually probably be a full circle of trees and plants growing on the waste of the wood because it's so nutritious. And that in itself then create a new circle of canopy, a new circle of life.
Artist Stan Brooks describing his word, The Nest, which can be found in Merricutta Woods near Aberdeen. If you'd like to see a picture of it, take a look at the Outdoors Facebook page.
Yeah, quite a lot of stuff up there at the moment. I've got some stuff up on my attempt at carving Pictic stones. You've got a picture of tapping water from birch trees.
Oh, it's a short video of, you know, how they actually get birch water out of the tree. I still want somebody to explain to me why, for 3 weeks, at this time of year roughly, the tree flushes itself with water. Not with sap, but water. What's the point behind that? Now, I can understand, I suppose, the physics of it in draining the water from the tree, because it's a bit like keeping water in pipes in freezing conditions.
No, it doesn't work that way, because they need, I think, it's the suction from the water that eventually pulls the sap up, because you would have to be, there's nothing down there to pump the sap up. You have to draw it up. And it's the evaporation of the water in the leaves creates a vacuum in the capillaries or in the veins. Sorry, I'm interrupting.
No, you weren't interrupting me at all. No, just that you just kind of jumped on several months. I was talking about at the end of the summer, coming into the winter when you've got freezing conditions. You can understand why the tree drains itself. It's a bit like draining a central heating system so that the pipes don't burst in the wintertime. If the tree was full of water in sub-zero conditions, it would split the tree.
But that's why the leaves fall off. Breaks a vacuum and the water falls down.
You know, you're going back to an earlier point. You know, you look at an earlier stage. What I was asking is, why does it flush with water in the first place? But you may have explained that. Most unusually.
I think we may be boring the rest of the world here.
Not often you hear an argument on a podcast, is it?
We're happy.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go back to Glencoe. Earlier, I went for a wander in the Glen with Emily Bryce, who's operations manager there, and we got to talking about the fact that the visitor centre is really essential for explaining to people what it is they're visiting, what they're seeing, what the history of the place is. They're in the middle of a major refurbishment at the moment, and Emily showed me around.
As you can see, it is a little bit of a building site here at the moment.
Slightly, yeah.
We are less than a month away from opening this to the public again.
A month?
Yes, in advance of the Easter weekend is when we're planning to open to the public again. And everything is on schedule, but it's the nature of building projects like this that everything comes together in the last month. And this building site will be transformed into our new visitor centre, which is still mainly within the footprint of the existing, really eco-friendly building that was put here about 15 years ago. But inside, everything's really been transformed to make it a lot brighter and fresher and engaging, so we're very excited.
We can't go in the front because basically they've torn up the floor in the front, so we'll need to go in through the back of the building. It's always surprised me how well hidden this building is.
That was always part of the design for the visitor centre. It's designed to feel like you're entering a woodland glade, and the buildings themselves are designed to be a sort of a real mismatch of buildings like you
more
might
like a
have
village,
had in
actually. It's kind of like a wee village.
Crofting community. Mm-hmm. The idea is that we've got some of the roofs are made of slate, we've got tin, wood cladding, but it's all designed to look like it's sort of just developed over time rather than being plonked here.
Yeah.
The buildings are on stilts so that actually it has a minimal impact on the ground underneath. And we have our wood chip boiler, make use of the water from the springs on the hill. It's designed to have a minimal environmental footprint.
Where's the best place to start, actually, having a look around the inside then?
Okay, well, if we head over towards the cafe, or the cafe in a month's time, you'll get a feel for what we're doing here.
Yeah.
Whereas in the past, the Glencoe Visitor Centre had one exhibition where you found out everything you could possibly want to know about Glencoe. Extremely informative, lots of wordy panels of information. What we found is that actually a large proportion of our visitors were not actually making it to the Visitor Centre exhibition. And so they weren't really getting a feel for the stories and why this place is special. So the cafe is going to have on every single table, on every wall. You will get a different story, whether the stories is of the geology, the origins of the glen, the wildlife and the seasons, whether the film connections that make this place famous around the world. There's going to be listening posts on the bench there, which faces out towards all the views. You'll be able to hear some of the stories and folklore that's traditional in this area. We've got sculptures hanging from the ceiling, a rather gigantic pine cone, a golden
eagle.
That's
magnificent. What is that made of?
It's all made of metalwork. Some of these sculptures, if you can see, they look quite rusty, but they're actually quite new. Well, that was achieved by apparently pouring tenants' lager over them, and that got the metalwork to kind of corrode faster than it would otherwise have done.
You got a wee Highland Coo calf at the far end there, and then this is an osprey and a stag's head. The pine cone, I've got to go and take a closer look at that, because it is about, I don't know, 6 feet long. And you can hear it. The whole thing, each individual segment of the pine cone is made of a piece of metal. That's beautiful.
So the next place to have a quick look is in our exhibition area. And one of the things that we're going to have in the new visitor centre is a 50-seater film screening room.
All right, you're going to have your own wee cinema.
Yes, and it is designed so that if, say, a coach tour was to come, you could fit 50 people in. But we're also quite excited about the possibilities it offers for us having local community film screenings, because there isn't otherwise a local cinema for quite a distance. So we can use it for lots of things, but there will be a 10-minute everything you could possibly want to know about Glencoe film that will be on all the way through the day. The first exhibition we're going to have in here is titled Pioneers of the Peaks, and we're working with our sort of local mountaineering community on this. And so the Scottish Mountaineering Club, who had such an important role right back at the start of the NTS acquiring Glencoe, plus the Ladies Scottish Climbing Club and Glencoe Mountain Rescue Team and the Scottish Avalanche Service have all worked with us on this to really pull out from the archives lots of really interesting imagery and stories which chart the growth of mountaineering in Glencoe over the last century and why it's such a cherished place amongst Scottish hillwalkers and mountaineers.
So that's going to be the style of it from now on. Essentially, you will have one big exhibition a year with other ancillary things going on.
As I mentioned before, the stories of the glen are going to be told whether you're in the shop, in the cafe, you'll be immersed in that. But we wanted to have one place where we focus on a particular theme each year. This year it's mountaineering, it could be the geology, many other themes, but that will be a changing annual exhibition that people can come back for and enjoy each year.
It's rather a difficult balancing act though, isn't it? You know, being a major visitor attraction in Scotland and being inobtrusive at the same time.
Yes, and I mean, we ultimately want everybody who comes to Glencoe to see this as their gateway to enjoying and exploring and understanding why it's an incredible place. But we want to do it in a way that is sensitive to the landscape and sensitive to just how natural a beauty there is here. That is what makes people go, wow. And if the buildings can kind of complement that, then that's great.
Emily Bryce from the National Trust for Scotland at the Glencoe Visitor Centre, which, if it all goes to plan, will be up and running again in several weeks.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast, the programme that makes people go, wow.
Scotland Outdoors Podcast, the programme that makes people go, if I stand here for longer than 20 seconds, somebody's going to put that router back on again, or a chop saw, or an electric drill, or whatever. It was one of the most difficult recording environments I've ever been in.
Yeah.
Boy, they're busy at the moment.
We were trying to record in Edinburgh this week, and it's only when you listen carefully.
Oh.
You've got the ice cream van,
yeah,
the buses, the cranes, the ambulances and the fire engines. It's a noisy world we live in.
It's a very noisy world. Anyway, that's all we've got time for in this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. Thanks very much for downloading us. From all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.